Good day, and welcome to the California Horse Racing Board Report on Horse Fatalities at Santa Anita Park Teleconference. Please be aware that each of your lines are in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given as to the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Rick Boedeker. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rick Boedeker, Executive Director of the CHRB. I'm joined on the call by our chairman, Dr. Greg Ferraro, Dr. Rick Arthur, our equine medical director, and official state veterinarians Tim Grande and Alina Vale. Also joining me are Sean Lair, our chief of enforcement, and Rod Brodnick and Amanda Brown, our staff attorneys. First, I want to mention a note about the indictments that were handed down yesterday by the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. We have begun an investigation into the charges within that report that relate in any way to racing in California, and we will not have any comments until that investigation is completed. We can point out, however, that we retain post-race urine samples here in California for 2 years, and we can and will test any of them retroactively. Also, CHRB Rule 1902B gives the board clear authority to take action against a licensee who engages in any conduct detrimental to racing. Also want to mention a note about the timeline for issuing this report. We originally hoped to issue it late last year, but the report was too complex and required too much review to meet that deadline. We also had intended to issue it in two phases, beginning with an executive summary, but we concluded that the 23 case files at the end of the report are too critical to leave out. So this is the report itself, the one that's posted online, not an executive summary. Last week, we advised the governor's office, the Business Consumer Services and Housing Agency, along with key legislative committees, that we would be issuing the report today, March 10. We welcomed their feedback and input. As I said in the cover page to the document, we, of course, look for any violations of CHRB rules, and there will be complaints filed as a result of our findings. But we were also determined to uncover weaknesses in the way horses were cared for, in the way racing was conducted, and including the way racing was regulated by the CHRB during the time frame in question. The purpose was and is to identify the weaknesses and work to eliminate them. The board has already adopted several measures to do so. The goal is simple, to establish a pervasive culture of safety surrounding the horse. We will now take your questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please dial the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, simply dial star 2. Again, to ask a question at this time, please dial star 1. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. The first question will come from Craig Figner with KNX. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for your time. So I want to make sure I understand on the, you say there will be complaints filed. What complaints will be filed and for what alleged violations?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and refer that to our attorney, Rob Brodnick. Rob?
On page 3 of our report, we do detail that, but there will be complaints filed forthcoming. 7 of them relate to violations of Rule 1842, our veterinarian report, for failing to turn in daily vet reports. And 3 complaints will be filed alleging rule violations of 1849, duties of a trainer, and 1489 regarding training without the proper license.
And then my other question is when you talk about changing kind of the culture of racing, is there anything that you've learned in this study of these catastrophes that maybe suggests horses are being pushed out onto the track at too young an age? Because I know that's something that has been brought up as a possibility for a connection to injury.
This is Dr. Arthur. I'd be happy to answer that. There's no evidence in this report that training horses as 2-year-olds is related to any of these injuries. Remember that this was in the beginning of the year. There were no 2-year-olds involved in this particular series of horses, and there's very good documentary evidence that training horses at a young age, particularly to withstand the rigors of race training, is actually beneficial to them and actually is safer in the long run.
I guess as a follow-up and final thought or question, will there be a similar look at the racehorse deaths at Santa Anita Track that happened after March 31st of 2019?
Yeah, we've changed the way that we investigate fatalities. We now involve a CHRB investigator. The difference is that in the past, by law, every horse that that dies within a CHRB enclosure must be reported to the CHRB within an hour, and then that horse has to be transported to the laboratory for a necropsy. In the past, the necropsy results have been discussed with the connections with the racehorse, and also those have been very important elements of studies conducted at UC Davis. But we've changed the focus of that now. We're involving an investigator from the outset. When necessary, we are issuing subpoenas to get any medical records or invoicing records and the like, anything else that we've earmarked as important for the investigation. Then the investigation is conducted with the official vet, and so it's much more comprehensive and results in an investigative report being filed.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, one of the recommendations was actually for an official veterinarian to be assigned specifically for the fatality review process.
Kind of be a specialist in that area, right, Doc?
That's right.
Understood. Thank you again.
Thank you for the question. The next question will come from John Chirwa with Los Angeles Times. Please go ahead.
I think this question is probably for Dr. Arthur. Of the 23 necropsies or horses that you looked at, how many of those injuries, or whether it be a percentage or an actual number, could have been prevented if the proper equipment or the proper diagnostics were done first?
That's sort of a difficult question to answer. There certainly, we did identify pre-existing pathology in 21 of the 22 fatal injuries. Whether those could have been recognized even with the PET scan, it's hard to say. But I will say that the predominant injury, which is the one that's illustrated in the report, was actually found in 9 out of the 19 proximal sesamoid bone fractures that were involved in this particular series. That at least gives us an indication that there was an opportunity to identify those lesions prior to the catastrophic event. Yes.
Okay. And my second question is, when you go through the necropsies of the report, excessive training comes up an awful lot. Is it your belief or the belief of the board that horses are trained too hard throughout their career, and is it different in California than perhaps the East Coast?
Yes, we've known for a number of years that the number of works per start in California is much higher than it is in the rest of the country. You will actually see before the end of the week, when they're posted on the website, an exercise history of all these horses. We had Dr. Sue Stover, who has done a lot of work with exercise intensity and its relationship to the type of injuries that we're seeing, analyze these particular group of horses. And what we did find, surprisingly enough, is not only are these horses at this particular time trained more than they are with other horses elsewhere in the country, but we also know that they were trained harder in terms of more high-speed furlongs than they were even 8 years ago, last time that she conducted a study similar to what was done here. So in that sense, the indication is that horses are overtrained or overraced, and one of the recommendations is we try to determine a way to actually try to figure out a limit on when horses get too many high-speed furlongs. That's an accumulation of both racing and working.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Arthur. If I can have one more question to Dr. Ferraro. In there, it was said you were going to consider that Santa Anita continue to pursue or look at going to synthetics. Is it possible that the board will take up the idea that synthetic racing be once again mandated in California?
I don't think you're going to see us mandate anything in the near future. Yeah, certainly synthetic tracks are under consideration and being investigated, but the question is, if you want to switch to synthetics, what synthetic? The last experiment we had with that didn't work out very well. And so until you come up with a surface that you're pretty confident on that it's going to work for us, I don't see the investment going forward. And I would doubt seriously it would be mandated by the board. We would work in conjunction with any racetrack that was interested in making a conversion, but I don't see us mandating anything, at least in the near future.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. The next question will come from Jason Henry with Southern California News Group. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much. I had a question about the medications. It was mentioned in the report that there were no illegal medications or procedures. Does that include medications that were over the limit?
Yes, it does. There were no, I can't remember any violations that were associated with any of these. One thing to remember, however, that in a post-mortem sample, we can't do quantitation the way you can on a horse that goes back to the test barn. That there's some technical issues with the hemolysis of the blood, or if we use other matrices beyond a blood and urine, we can't do thresholds with a degree of accuracy. It has to do with the hemolysis of the blood that you get in a post-mortem sample.
And because I know the report mentioned that the record keeping was poor, how was it determined that no illegal medications were given?
By the toxicology that is discussed in the report.
We've explained
in the report where those different samples come from. For example, with a horse that races, we were able to use the TCO sample to actually do the quantitation type of levels you're talking about. If it was a training sample where we may not have even had anybody on the racetrack, I'm talking about the CHRB, then we would have taken a postmortem sample. So in terms of all the horses that were racing, we knew that they were competing under the regulations in place at the time.
And, sir, I'd just like to make a note about the record keeping. The reference in the findings was to record keeping by horsemen. That's different than record keeping by veterinarians, because we do have a rule that requires a veterinarian to submit all veterinary administrations to the board within 24 hours. And so there's actually very good record keeping from a veterinary standpoint. And as we said at the outset, we did have some instances where the records that were submitted to CHRB didn't necessarily match some of the documents that we received via subpoena. And in those cases, we're pursuing complaints. Just wanted to make that distinction.
Okay, and then,
thank you for the
sorry, just one additional question if I can. In the report, it does mention that all the treatments were administered within CHRV regulations with one exception. Is that one exception going to result in a complaint?
Do you know which one is you're referring to?
Yes, we are aware of that, and we are pursuing a complaint related to that case.
Okay, thank you for the question.
You.
The next question will come from Tarpley Hitt with the Daily Beast. Please go ahead.
Hello. So the report talks about this perception of pressure to race, and only one trainer provided a specific example. So it seems like the perception of pressure to race comes more from atmosphere. And I'm wondering, what sort of concrete actions can you take to mitigate that perception?
You know, I think that that's a little bit of a difficult question to answer because there's a practical context to that answer, and then there's probably a regulatory one. From a practical standpoint, I think it's simply establishing a working relationship with racetrack management, the trainers organization, and the board. That's kind of a day-to-day effort to reduce any such pressure. However, it's possible to cross a line where someone is perhaps forced to enter a horse or feels forced to enter a horse when the horse shouldn't have been entered, and that can result in a violation of a CHRB rule. But I think that, as a matter of fact, it was very interesting to us that only one trainer actually gave a specific example. And it's very common, as a matter of fact, that in the small world of racing, some things may get blown out of proportion. But we just stuck to the facts that that we gained from our study.
Thank you.
Thank you. As a quick reminder to ask a question, that is star one. The next question will come from Beth Harris with Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering, was the report previously shared with Santa Anita Ownership?
No. There was a courtesy copy sent to certain stakeholders shortly before the report was sent to the media this morning.
Okay. And what expectations do you have that all or some of the recommendations will be implemented?
We have very good confidence that many of the recommendations will be implemented because a number already have been and a number are already in the process of being implemented. I think those are most of those are highlighted in the report where there's been proposed regulatory changes associated with what was found in the report. We didn't wait for the final report before we moved on some of the changes that were obvious that needed to be made. For example, the reduction in permitted medication that California led the way with actually starting last March and April.
This is Dr. Ferraro, Chairman of the Board. I can tell you that the long-term intention of the Board is to follow up on most of these recommendations. We've gone a long way towards changing the environment and changing the rules, but we're moving to reform racing as best we can over the next year to 18 months.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Mike Martin just jumping in. I just wanted to go back to your first question just to be absolutely clear. We provided this report to the stakeholders in California, which is the racetracks, fairs, and horsemen's groups at 8 a.m. this morning. That was the first time they had seen the report. So we gave them 2 hours so they could read it and then be able to respond to any questions that would be that might be forthcoming from the media. That's why we gave it to them 2 hours earlier, but no sooner than that.
Thank you. As a reminder, that is star one to enter the queue for a question. The next question will come from Daniel Ross with Thoroughbred Daily News. Please go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, so the report states many of the horsemen involved, quote, did not display good working knowledge of anatomy or grasp the significance of pre-existing lesions. Can you sort of explain that a little further and maybe give some examples of working knowledge of anatomy that they didn't grasp? And on the back of that, I know you guys are working towards this continuing ed requirements, but do you think on the back of this that you'll change any of the requirements that by which trainers can come about getting a license in the first place?
Well, let me jump in on the second part first, and that is that we've already changed the process for getting a trainer's license. I don't know if it's effective yet, but it's about to be, correct, Rob? And that is that in order to get a license, you had to pass a test, three components. There was a written test of about 150 questions. If you passed that, then you had to pass a horsemanship test, and finally you had to pass a test with the official veterinarian on medication rules and restrictions. At that point, you could be awarded a trainer's license. That's changed now. Going through that process will allow you to be awarded a provisional trainer's license. That is good for 1 year. It's basically an apprenticeship, if you will. You must work for a CHRB licensed trainer for a period of 1 year, after which that trainer must come to the stewards along with the provisional trainer and based on testimony from the licensed trainer, then that provision can be removed and you can get a full trainer's license. Did I state that accurately, Rob? Close enough?
I believe so.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Doc, on the other part of it, the physiology part.
One of the most disappointing aspects of this exercise, and it has been since we started the fatality review, is how few trainers actually had reviewed their necropsy reports prior to sitting down and going over them with Dr. Grande or previously with the other official vets around the state. And part and parcel of that is really a fairly basic lack of understanding of some of the critical anatomy of the distal extremity of the leg, particularly associated with the fetlock, but other structures as well. And that will be, anatomy will be a key component of a continuing education program going forward. And I wouldn't be surprised if we don't expand the requirement for the knowledge of anatomy in trainer's tests going forward as well.
There is a rule before the board. It's not completely adopted yet that we require 12 hours of continuing education in order to renew your trainer's license.
Thank you. As a reminder, that is star one to ask a question. The next question will come from Ray Pollock with PollockReport.com. Please go ahead. Mr. Pollock, please make sure your phone is not on mute, sir.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. The report, I think, said 21 of the 22 horses had a pre-existing pathology of some type. With the new diagnostic equipment that's either in place or coming, is there any way to project how many of these could have been prevented with that equipment?
I think I answered that question just a minute ago, but the fact is that 9 of the proximal sesamoid bone fractures had the abaxial lesions that's illustrated in the report that is not amenable to other diagnostic techniques besides the PET scan. And certainly in the first few weeks or first few months now of the PET scan, we've been able to identify that lesion on horses antemortem, in other words, horses that have not sustained a a catastrophic injury and those horses were rested and taken out of training. Having said that, the one concern that we do have, and I think we do mention it in the report in a number of individual cases, is that oftentimes these lesions are quiet. In other words, they're not showing a clinical sign or a nonspecific clinical sign, and so that the trainer and veterinarian would recognize that this horse actually needs to have a diagnostic imaging technique. And at this point, I think I should ask Dr. Grandi to jump in, who actually sat down and interviewed a number of these trainers with these about these lesions, and have him comment on the lack of clinical indication that the horse has a problem that needs additional diagnostic imaging. That's been the case for a long period of time. Even in the last year, we have nuclear scintigraphy right here at Santa Anita, and in the last month, we've had two humeral stress fractures that are very amenable to that particular technique. So, Dr. Grandi, do you have anything to add to what I just said?
Hey, yeah, this is Dr. Grandi. Yeah, I think just in general, a lot of the pathology that is pre-existing on these horses stays asymptomatic, even if you could find it with diagnostic imaging, such that trainers and the attending vets might not necessarily flag the horse for scrutiny. In that respect, the other issue, correlation of diagnostic techniques, for example, radiographs, don't quite match the severity on the necropsy findings. That's another blind spot, so to speak, in the education of horsemen. They kind of down, you know, we had several POD lesions, the plantar palmar osteochondral disease of moderate or even severe nature. But on radiographs, even if you did detect it, it might not be to the point where somebody would call it significant. So there's certainly a lot of education and technology in terms of PET scan and MRI that hopefully going forward is implemented on a more regular basis so that we can catch it ahead of time.
That answer your question?
It does, and I'm sorry I missed the earlier one. I was tied up on another call. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. As a reminder, that is star one to enter the queue. The next question will come from Jessica Ogilvie with KPCC.
Hi, thank you so much. My question is, I'm wondering, I think you're talking about lesions here. My question is about pre-existing injuries to the fetlock area. Are those something that you can diagnose in advance? And if you can, what protocol is in place to do that?
There's been this is Dr. Arthur, there's been a lot of effort in terms of trying to describe these particular lesions. And for example, as I've mentioned previously, there is an example of a lesion that Dr. Stover has identified as part of the review of the CHRB UC Davis necropsy program several years ago that we have been working to develop additional diagnostic techniques that specifically image that particular type of lesion. It is not amenable to other diagnostic lesions or imaging, plain radiography, even nuclear scintigraphy, but the PET scan appears to be very, very good at picking that lesion up. We also have installed an MRI unit here at Santa Anita recently, and there is a project going on funded by the Grayson Jockey Club Research Foundation to try to develop the clinical techniques to better identify these pre-existing lesions in the fetlock. And associated with that, Oak Tree Racing Association has contributed additional money to correlate PET scan to the MRI as well. So what we're trying to do is improve our diagnostic capabilities, and the key component of this is to educate horsemen so that they can recognize these somewhat difficult to identify lesions before they become a catastrophic injury.
Okay, thank you. I guess just one more adding on to that. Is there any sort of protocol for systematically examining horses in order to detect something pre-existing like that, as far as, so far as it can be detected?
We examine all horses prior to racing, and we've expanded those examination protocols, both Santa Anita and the California Horse Racing Board. So we're getting more and more examinations, and one of our recommendations is that when the examining veterinarians, the regulatory veterinarians that work for either the racetrack or the California Horse Racing Board, identify a case that we believe needs to have additional diagnostic imaging, whether or not the attending veterinarian or trainer agrees with us, that we can actually order those examinations where we think it's appropriate. We have done that to a limited degree in the last year or so, and even before the last year at Santa Anita on certain cases. But we're trying to expand that so that it is well understood that that is part and parcel of our safety program.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Again, that is star one at this time if you have a question. Speakers, I'm showing nothing further at this time.
Well, hearing none, then we will direct you to Mike Martin for any follow-up, and thank you for your participation. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's event. You may now disconnect your lines.